Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is February the 13th, and we are continuing in our redemption class. We're on page 296 in Parsha Shmos. Pasuk Zion, thank you. Verse 7. So we are in the middle of the paragraph that introduces Moshe Rabbeinu, and the pasuk says, after Basaro has already found Moshe, and she took pity on him. So then it says, Vatoma achoso el bas Paro. His sister, Moshe's sister, said to the daughter of Paro, Ha'elech, shall I go? V'karasi lach isha meinekes. I call for you a wet nurse, Mino Ivrios, from the Jewish women, V'senik lach esayolen, and she will nurse for you the baby. Daughter Paro said to her, go. And the young lady went. And she called the mother of the child. So she actually called Yocheved to nurse Moshe Rabbeinu. So an incredible hashkacha, an incredible intervention by Hashem, even though it was not an open miracle, but that he arranged things that Moshe Rabbeinu would continue to be nurtured by his own mother, even though he was being raised in Paro's household. Rashi draws it to our attention in the name of our sages that the term ha'alma, which means the young lady, the word elem or elem also can mean a deer or a some type of a, I don't know if exactly a deer or a gazelle or something like that, one of these types of animals that can run very quickly and jump and move along very fast. So she moved very quickly. She went to her mother like one of these, like a deer. She went very quickly to go get her mother. Pasuk test verse 9. Vatomer la bas Paro, and the daughter of Paro said to her, Heilichi es hayel hazev ein kiuli, take this boy and nurse him for me. Vani atena secharech, and I will pay you. I'll give you your wages. And the woman, meaning Yocheved, took the boy and nursed him. So as we pointed out last time, not only did Yocheved get to nurture her own son, but she was even paid to do it. And this is right under the nose of Paro. Right under the nose of Paro, his own daughter has saved the one who will eventually take the Jews out of Egypt. And right under the nose of Paro, he is being nurtured and nursed by his own mother, and his own mother is being paid, ostensibly from the royal treasury, to nurse this boy who is going to grow up and take the Jews out of Egypt. So, again, you see Hashem's intervention. Yod, verse 10, Vaigdal HaYelad, the boy grew older, Vativyehu Levas Paro, she brought him to the daughter of Paro, Vayimo Levain, and she was to him as a son. Vatikra Shemo Moshe, she called his name Moshe. Atoma, she said, Kimin Hamayim Mishisihu, for I took him out of the water. From the water I took him out. So once he got older, once he was weaned, then the daughter of Paro, then Yocheved brought him to the daughter of Paro, and he became to her as a son. She raised him after he was weaned. Typically, that would be 24 months, 2 years old. That would be the normal time to nurse a child. And at that point, he was brought to the daughter of Paro, and she raised him. Of course, he has already had significant influence from his mother in his first 2 years of life. And then Bas Paro, the daughter of Paro, raises him after that. And as we said, the daughter of Paro had given up the paganism of her father's house and now is trying to follow the one God. And she named him Moshe. As we mentioned last time, Moshe actually has many names. He has, if you go look in Divrei Hayomim and Chronicles, you'll find that Moshe actually has 10 names, not just one, but 10 names. Some of them are Avigdor is one of them. What's that?
Yekusiel.
I don't remember. Yekusiel could be. Okay. There's Tov is one of his names. Right. Or Tovia, right? So you have various names, but Moshe is the name that we use, and that is the name that the daughter of Paro gave him, is Moshe. And she names him that, and I took you out of water, from the water I took you out. And many of the commentaries say that this name is to reflect to Moshe how he is, what he is supposed to do in the future, that his mission is to take the Jews out. Just as he was taken out of the water, so too he is to take the Jews out of Egypt. It reflects what his mission would be later in life. So this is the Moshe's being born and finally ending up in the house of Potiphar, where he will be raised until adulthood, which is the next story in the Chumash. Yes?
Who did Potiphar think this boy was?
I don't know.
What was the question?
Who did Potiphar think this boy was? I don't know. Good question.
She hired him
at all? Doesn't say she had him. Mm-hmm.
She was MacGyver because he talks about that she was in the mikvah. Did she keep him from eating treifa?
Okay, so we're going to talk about that right now. Okay. Okay.
You might want to think about that when he was in the
Shabbat.
The Shema was with him, and he so a lot of kedusha there. So how are you protecting the pounds?
So the when Miriam comes to the daughter of Paro and says to her, shall I call you a wet nurse from the Jewish women? So Chazal say, our sages tell us that the daughter of Paro tried to find an Egyptian woman to nurse the baby. And she went to many nursing Egyptian women. And the baby refused to nurse for many of these women. And so the daughter of so then Miriam stepped forward and said to the daughter of Paro, shall I go get a nursing woman? Which means that Miriam wasn't just there at the Nile. She shadowed Bas Paro. She tried to stay in contact. Obviously, Hashem helped her out, that she was able to somehow follow wherever the daughter of Paro went trying to get this baby to nurse. It wouldn't be that long period of time, because obviously if a baby goes too long a period of time without eating, it's very dangerous. So it would have been a matter of hours, you would think. But when Miriam saw the daughter of Paro was not successful in finding someone who could nurse Moshe, then she stepped forward and offered to go get a Jewish woman, and she got her own mother. So this then brings up the question, so why did Moshe not nurse from the Egyptian women? So Moshe at that age would not have been able to make a choice like that. He was only 3 months old. So clearly Hashem didn't allow him to nurse from the Egyptian women. Why not? So our sages tell us because the mouth that would eventually speak to Hashem's divine presence, to the Shekhinah, that mouth could not nurse from the Egyptian women. That's what our sages tell us. The implication is that it is normally permissible to have a Jewish baby nurse from a non-Jewish woman. It was only with Moshe that it was not acceptable, because Moshe had that special status where he was eventually going to speak directly to Hashem and converse with Hashem's divine presence, with the Shekhinah. So Moshe couldn't nurse from a non-Jewish woman. But the implication is everybody else could. So the question is, so what is the halacha? How do we rule on this question about a Jewish baby nursing from a non-Jewish woman? The Medrash says that the milk of a mother can have profound effects on a child. The Gemara tells us, the Medrash tells the story of Antoninus. Antoninus was one of the Roman Caesars, and Antoninus, in stark contrast to most of the Roman leaders, most of the Roman leaders were very anti-Semitic and were very difficult for us to deal with, and made life very difficult for the Jews. But Antoninus was an exception. Not only was he very friendly to the Jewish people, he was particularly fond of and respectful towards Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, he is the sage who compiled the Mishnah. Now, compiling the Mishnah was a very difficult thing to do. Let's digress for a moment into the history of the recording of the oral law. We know the Torah has the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah in front of us, and the Torah has the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah. The oral Torah was transmitted to Moshe on Har Sinai, on Mount Sinai, along with the written Torah. The term oral Torah was meant to be just that, transmitted orally, and transmitted from generation to generation, from teacher to student, orally. And we, therefore, today, had the transmission gone the way it should have gone, would be studying the oral Torah only orally, which means the only text we would have in front of us would be the written Torah, not any of the other things on this page. Most of what we have on this page is the oral Torah. Everything except for the Hebrew letters here is the oral Torah, which means that the translation of Uklis is the oral Torah, the commentary of Rashi is the oral Torah, the English translation is the oral Torah, the English commentary is the oral Torah. Even the vowel signs and the cantillation signs, even that is the oral Torah. The only thing that is the written Torah would be just the Hebrew letters, the Hebrew words, like you find in a Torah scroll. Everything else is the oral Torah. And if we were studying Chumash the way that our ancestors did after the Torah was received, we would have in front of us only a scroll with the, just like we have in Shul, that's all we would have, and we would then express everything else orally. We would talk about everything else. We would teach and learn orally only. But, as we know, that lasted a good long time, that the Jews were able to still remain proficient and experts in the Torah, even though most of it was done orally, and that was fine, until the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. When the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, at that time, which is nearly 2,000 years ago, at that time, because of the exile and the difficulties the Jews were going through, it became harder and harder to maintain the high level of scholarship necessary to remember all of the oral Torah. The oral Torah is vast, and to remember it all became more and more difficult. And then there were two stages in which the oral Torah got written down. The first was the Mishnah, and the second was the Gemara. The Mishnah was an attempt to write down parts of the oral Torah in shorthand, in very succinct sentences that a scholar could use it as notes to read a few lines and from there remember a vast amount of knowledge. But it was a way of, like an outline, of remembering a lot of knowledge through just a few cases. That would be the purpose of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was written down by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He's the one who compiled it. He didn't write it all himself, meaning he didn't make it all up himself. He compiled it from all of the sages of his time, all of whom remembered different things, had different traditions from their teachers. He brought it all together and set it down as the Mishnah. That's what he did. And that's approximately the year 190 or so, something like that, is when the Mishnah was actually recorded. That, no. Yeah, no, common error. Common error. It would be post the destruction of the temple. That system worked fine for approximately 300 years, and right around the year 500 is when the Gemara, the Talmud, was recorded. And that was because at that point it was recognized that even the Mishnah would not be sufficient to keep the Jews from losing the scholarship in Torah. It was just too difficult, too many persecutions, too much running around, being thrown from country to country, not having the stability of living in Israel with a temple, with a king, etc. And so the Gemara was compiled and recorded, and from that point on, it's almost open season. We write down virtually everything. There was still an attempt not to write down too much other than the Gemara, but as time has gone on today, we have no inhibitions whatsoever, no restriction whatsoever. We write down everything. We have people taking notes in this class. That's normal. That's the way we do it because we know we can't remember it. We're not able. We don't have that level of scholarship to remember it in the way they used to. But the Mishnah was the first attempt at writing down not everything, but writing down just the notes necessary to jog one's memory so that they could have the entire thing. This was done by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Now, it was not an easy thing to do because from the time that the temple was destroyed, the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Jews were in a state of severe persecution. There was tremendous anti-Semitism. The Romans were very, very hard on the Jews. And there was just, it was extremely difficult to maintain scholarship and learning. But it was also difficult to get the sages together in one place where they would be able to sit without being bothered for an extended period of time and put their heads together and decide what would be recorded in the Mishnah and do it and to essentially have a conference. And the conference would have to take at least several weeks, maybe months, to compile the Mishnah. And it was impossible to do. The Jews couldn't meet in any mass way. They would have been attacked by the Romans. They weren't allowed to do that. They couldn't. You couldn't openly teach Torah. Then you'd be executed by the Romans. Rabbi Akiva, the great sage Rabbi Akiva, was executed for doing what? For teaching Torah publicly. That's why he was executed by the Romans. And this was a commonplace thing. The Romans were very, very anti the study of Torah. In the days of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, of Rabbi Judah the Prince, in his day, Antoninus became the leader of the Romans. And Antoninus, as I said before, in stark contrast to the leaders who came before him and after him, was benevolent in the Jewish people. This was not coincidental. Hashem allowed for such a thing to happen so that there would be a period of calm in which Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was one of the greatest sages to live since Rabbi Akiva, to give Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi the ability to bring everybody together, all the sages of the generation together, and to compile the Mishnah. And that saved the Torah. Because then, after he passed away, and his generation passed away, the next generation could not have been able to remember all of the oral Torah without the Mishnah as an aid in their study. And so the rise of Antoninus to power in Rome brought about the writing, the recording of the Mishnah. Okay, so we're going to get there. Now, Antoninus, what is the story of Antoninus? When Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, before we get even to that, Antoninus enjoyed a very close relationship with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi particularly. He had great respect for the sage and was willing to divest himself of all the typical honors that are given to a king whenever he was with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He did not expect Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi to treat him with any degree of royal respect. He wanted to be a regular student of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. That's what Antoninus wanted. The Gemara records that at one point that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was had to get up into his bed. And Rabbi Yochanan was elderly, and Antoninus laid down on the floor so that Rabbi Yochanan could step on him and get up into bed. That's as far as Antoninus went. Antoninus, he was essentially the most powerful man in the world. He was the head of the Roman Empire, but he wanted to be a student and to be subservient to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wouldn't do it. He said, I can't do that. He said to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, said to Antoninus, it is not appropriate to treat a king in this manner. Even if the king wants to be treated in that manner, it is still inappropriate. And so he wouldn't do that. But still, you can see how far Antoninus' respect for Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi went. They enjoyed a very close relationship. It was done in secret, because Antoninus was aware that if the rest of the Roman leadership would get wind of the fact that Antoninus was so pro-Jewish, Antoninus would most certainly be deposed. And so it was done in secret. And the Gemara tells us that he had a secret passageway that he would use to get to go visit Rabbi, go through this secret passageway to go visit his good friend, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi.
What made him so sympathetic to the Jews?
Okay, so what made him so sympathetic to the Jews? So the Gemara tells us, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was born, at that time, the Roman Empire, which, as I said before, they were terribly anti-Semitic, and did all kinds of things to stop the Jews from studying Torah and from practicing our religion, they made a decree that banned Bris Mila, that banned circumcision. And anyone who would circumcise their baby boy would be put to death. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was born, obviously a boy, and his parents defied the decree and circumcised their baby. Word got out, somebody tipped off the Romans that they had done so. Obviously they did it as privately as possible, but it was discovered that they had done so. They were summoned before the Roman tribunal. And when they were summoned, they were told to bring their baby with them to the Roman tribunal, which would then decide their fate. When they got there, so what were they going to do? Obviously, if the boy was circumcised, it would be evident and there would be no way of avoiding the Roman decree. And so what Mrs. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, really his mother, did is this, she was, again, this would have to do with Hashem's intervention. Somehow she came across a Roman infant the same age as her baby, and or at least looks the same age as her baby, and somehow when whoever was attending that Roman infant wasn't looking, she switched the infants. And when she came before the tribunal, she was actually carrying a Roman infant. And then they demanded to see whether there was a circumcision, and there was no circumcision. And so they were let off the hook. And then on her way out, a double miracle took place because she was able to switch the babies back. Imagine what the hospitals would go through when they hear this sort of story. So she was able to switch the babies once and then switch the babies back on her way out again. And the parents of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi were saved from the Roman decree. Moreover, the Gemara tells us, the Medrash tells us, that when the Roman who had tipped off the authorities was so convinced that he knew that there was a circumcision, and when this happened, that all of a sudden the baby wasn't circumcised, he said to himself, the God of the Jews performs miracles, because he thought that God had essentially changed the physical appearance of the baby. But he was so shocked that what happened. He said, the God of the Jews causes miracles, and he therefore told apparently he was an influential person, and he told the Roman authorities, there is no point in this decree, because you obviously can't catch the Jews, God's going to take care of them, and they rescinded the decree. So not only was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi saved, but then the decree was lifted and circumcision was then allowed. Who was the baby that was switched with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi? It was Antoninus. Not only that, was in Antoninus, but the Medrash says that while the parents of Rabbi Yudah Nasi were waiting for the tribunal, I mean, if you have an infant, infants get hungry. Well, the infant got fussy, and Rabbi Yudah Nasi's mother had to nurse the baby. But the baby wasn't her baby, it was Antoninus. And she nursed Antoninus. The Medrash says, as a result of this holy woman nursing this Roman baby, that influenced the Roman baby, and he grew to be Antoninus, and he was sympathetic to the Jewish people, even though he wouldn't have known the story. He was an infant, he couldn't possibly know what happened, but there was a subtle effect on this baby that grew and was in fact sympathetic to the Jewish people and eventually got close to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And the Medrash tells us that in the end, before he died, Antoninus actually converted to Judaism and circumcised himself. As a result, remember, in those days, no one circumcised themselves except for Jews. It wasn't a common practice. It was very unusual for anybody to do it. And Antoninus was circumcised before he died as a Jew. That is the story the Medrash tells about Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. The Medrash's point in the whole story is the power of nursing from a particular person. And therefore the Medrash says that even though it may be technically permissible for a Jewish baby to nurse from a non-Jewish mother, it is technically permissible. However, you see the profound effect that the nursing from a Jewish mother had on Antoninus. And therefore, the Medrash concludes that if at all possible, a Jewish baby ought to nurse from a Jewish mother. Now, the question is, what is the reason for that? Again, according to the halacha, it would seem that it is permissible for a Jewish baby to nurse from a non-Jewish mother. It was only Moshe who wasn't able to do it, but normally it would be permissible. The Medrash is saying, nevertheless, even though it is technically permissible, it is best, if possible, for the Jewish baby to nurse from a Jewish mother. But what is the reason for this? Is the reason because one is Jewish and one is not Jewish? Or is the reason because one is eating kosher food and one is eating non-kosher food? What is the reason for the profound effect? Because we know today, better than they knew then, we know that what a nursing mother eats is directly fed to the baby. Now obviously it has changed, chemically it's changed into milk. But we know that when a nursing mother, for instance, takes alcohol, that it will affect the baby. Nursing mother takes different types of drugs or medicine, it will affect the baby. We know that it passes through into the baby. We're aware of this, and therefore nursing mothers are often very careful about what they eat. In a less dramatic way, we know that babies can get fussy depending on what their mother eats. Sometimes colicky babies, it's a result of what the mother has eaten when she's nursing her baby. So we know that the food that the mother eats will find its way into the milk. There'll be an expression of that food in the milk itself, which can affect the baby. And so this is the direction that is taken by the Rambam of Moshe Esos in Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. And he writes that although it is permissible for a Jewish baby to nurse from a non-Jewish mother, however, if at all possible, it is best if a Jewish baby nurses only from a person who is eating kosher food. See, even if it's a non-Jewish woman who nurses, there could be a situation where the mother is unable to nurse her baby. And today, thank God, there's formula. That's a relatively new invention. It was always the case that you needed someone to nurse the baby. Well, if there's no Jew to nurse the baby, you need a non-Jew. If possible, he writes, if that's the case, then one should try to have that woman, that non-Jewish woman, eat only kosher food. Because that way, the baby, even though he's nursing from a non-Jewish woman, will still be having nursing from the person who's eating kosher food. That the transmission of what is being eaten that goes through the milk will still be a kosher type of expression. Now, let me make it clear. Mother's milk is kosher irrespective of what the mother ate. The milk is not non-kosher. If a woman eats pork and then nurses her baby, the milk is still kosher. It's not not kosher. It is kosher. But there is this subtle effect. That's what the Medrash is saying. It's not saying that if a Jewish baby nurses from a mother who ate non-kosher, that the Jewish baby is eating non-kosher food. No. The milk is kosher. But there is a subtle effect based on what the mother is eating. Just as when, and I'll tell you right now, just as when my wife drinks grape juice, then the baby has trouble sleeping. So that's a subtle effect. It's not that the milk is grape juice. The milk is not grape. The milk is milk. It's not grape juice. But it has a subtle effect on the baby. The baby can't sleep properly. Same thing over here. And the mother eats non-kosher food. It has a subtle effect. But it is, according to the letter of the law, it is kosher. Once we're on this topic, I do want to just fill in the rest of the discussion of the kosher kosher status of mother's milk, just to be aware of it. I'd like to fill in, not directly related to what we're learning here, but I would like to fill in the blanks on the kosher status of mother's milk, which I'll get to in a moment. You have a question?
Oh, isn't there another more subtle influence other than kosher or non-kosher food? I mean, wouldn't you think that...
Not necessarily through the nursing.
He had said unclean milk, so it's... Same thing.
Yeah. Now, in the halachos, in the laws of mother's milk, so there is an interesting discussion about what happens if a child has been weaned, and then the mother wants to nurse the baby again, or the baby wants to nurse. Can the baby be caused to nurse after the baby has already been weaned? So within the first 24 months, there is no discussion. Within the first 24 months, a baby can nurse, be weaned, be brought back to nursing. There's no discussion. It's totally permissible. There's nothing to talk about. Once you get past 24 months, as long as the baby has not been weaned, they can keep on going. They can keep going till 4 years old and keep going. At a certain point, most mothers wouldn't want their baby to nurse. But theoretically, 3 years old, 4 years old is permissible as long as the baby has not been weaned. Once the child is weaned, which means they've gone 3 days without nursing, then if it's past 24 months, it is prohibited to begin nursing them again. Now, obviously, if it's a matter of life and death, there's nothing else for the baby to eat, God forbid, then we're not talking about that kind of case. We're talking about what are alternatives. What's this prohibition is only to nurse directly from the mother. If the milk is expelled and put into a container, that milk is kosher. And it is permissible to drink that milk. Now, I understand that for most of us, we wouldn't consider such a thing. It would be, it's not something that we, you know, in our day and age, it's not something that people would do. But remember, there were times in history where people didn't have many things to eat. There wasn't much to eat. And so these questions would come up. And would it be permissible to feed, let's say, a 4, 5, 6-year-old child the milk of his mother? So the answer is, if the child has been weaned, as long as the milk is now in a container, then it could be given to another child, an older child, to drink. And that would be acceptable. So those are the basic rules of the kosher permissibility of mother's milk.
Yeah. Is there an explanation of
the rabbinic decree? It's a rabbinic decree. It's a rabbinic decree not to drink directly from the mother once the baby has been weaned, once in the past 24 months. It's a rabbinic decree, but the milk itself is kosher. There's nothing wrong with the milk. It's kosher milk, and you drink it. It should be noted, I've mentioned this before, I just want to reiterate it, that in the time of the Gemara, it is clear that the milk of choice, once a baby was weaned, the milk of choice that was drunk by everybody, not just children, but adults as well, was not cow's milk, but goat's milk. Right, I mentioned it before. Goat's milk was clearly the milk of choice, not cow's milk. Cows were used as oxen to plow, and they were used for meat, and those sorts of things. But milk was a goat's, was coming from a goat. That was primarily what it was used for. Yeah.
I guess I should know this. Maybe I missed the class. But we didn't have the Torah yet, so where did the kosher come from?
That's a very good question. So, you're right. And the answer would have to be that we know that the patriarchs and matriarchs kept the Torah, even before it was given. Not every aspect of the Torah, but most aspects of the Torah were kept by the patriarchs and matriarchs before the Torah was given. We know this already from Noah, who's not even one of the patriarchs. But Noah himself, we know that he knew a lot of Torah. How do we know that? Because he took two of each animal, male and female, except for kosher animals. Kosher animals, he took 14 of each animal because he was going to offer them as sacrifices. Because you can only offer a sacrifice from a kosher animal. You can't use a non-kosher animal for a sacrifice. He was going to offer them as sacrifices. Rashi tells us back in Parshas Noach, that shows that Noach studied Torah. He knew the Torah. Now, obviously, none of them knew it from reading it in a scroll. It wasn't given. But through their connection with Hashem, and through their prophecy, they did know a certain measure of Torah.
And that's the patriots, not the people.
Well, it was transmitted. It was transmitted. So you're right. It would not have been a prohibition. A Jew, before the Torah was given, could eat pork because the Torah had not been given yet. But the Jews who were trying to grow and trying to be close to Hashem did not eat pork even though they had not yet received the law.
Was there one compiler of the Gemara, just as there was Yehuda Nathanaki?
It was primarily two sages named Ravina and Rav Ashi. Those are the two primary sages of the Gemara. They themselves are mentioned in the Gemara several times. They were the latest stage sages of the Gemara.
Rishon
and Achronim? No, Rishon and Achronim follows the Gemara. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so what about Moshe got older in the palace and he would have to be tested to eat?
Yes.
Kasher.
Yes, so we're not given much information about Moshe once he was in the palace after he was 24 months, after he was 2 years old. So what happened there in the palace? There is the famous story about how he came to stutter. It doesn't say he stuttered, but how he developed a speech impediment. That's what it says. It says he's kvad peh, that he's a speech impediment. And the Gemara tells us that at one point Paro was concerned that Moshe was going to usurp his throne. That Moshe wanted his crown, wanted Paro's crown, and so Paro was given the advice to offer Moshe, baby Moshe, a choice of beautiful gems or hot coals, and let's see what he reaches for. And if he reaches for the beautiful gems, that will prove that he is a baby that is destined to grow up to usurp Paro, and he should be put to death. If he reaches for the hot coals, then it would prove that he was not out to usurp Paro, and he could be made alive. And the Medrash tells us that they were put before Moshe, and Moshe, of course, reached for that gems, because any baby would. They were glittery, and he reached for the gems, and an angel came and pushed Moshe's hand to the coals, and he touched the coals, and after he touched the coals, he reached and put his hand in his mouth, put a coal in his mouth, and therefore developed a severe speech impediment. And in that he kept the rest of his life. But through that, his life was saved. So there is that story. But other than that story, we don't know much about Moshe in the palace of Paro. We do have to assume that the daughter of Paro, knowing that he was a Jewish child, and she herself, having rejected the paganism of her father's household, would have tried her best to protect Moshe and tried to keep his environment a positive one. How she did that, I don't know, and to what extent she did it, I don't know. But Moshe certainly grows up with a sense of brotherhood with the Jews. As we find in the very next story, then Moshe reaches out to his Jewish brethren. He does not look at himself as an outsider. He looks towards the Jews. He looks at himself as one of his Jewish brethren.
Was the issue of what he ate after he was chewed, was that discussed?
No, that's what was just addressed.
That the daughter of Pharaoh.
We don't know. I mean, we have to assume something like that happened. Yeah. Pasuk Yud, verse 11, page 298. Here we have one of the more fascinating stories with Moshe. Vayihi bayamim ahem, it was in those days. Vayigdal Moshe grew up. Vayetzei elachav, and he went out to his brothers. Now immediately there's a problem here, because it already told us that Moshe grew up. The verse that precedes this one says Vayigdal Hayelet, the child grew up. The boy grew up. This one says Moshe grew up. So how many times did he grow up? I mean, I tell my children all the time, "Will you grow up?" But how many times can it happen? So the Medrash tells us, Rashi cites it over here, that the first one means he grew up. Physically, he matured. The second one is that he became an authority figure in Paro's household. Just as Yosef rose to power and greatness in the house of Potiphar, here Moshe rises to greatness within Paro's household. He recognizes Moshe's natural leadership abilities. He recognizes Moshe's success, and therefore he appoints Moshe, gives Moshe a post in his palace. That's what the second one means. He grew up, meaning he rose in stature. So Moshe grew up, he rose in stature, and he went out to his brothers. Vayar b'tziblosam, and he saw in their burdens. Vayar ish mitzri maket ish ivri me'achav. And he saw an Egyptian man striking a Jewish man from his brothers. Here we see twice the Torah refers in this verse to the Jews as Moshe's brothers. He went out to his brothers, striking a Jewish man from his brothers. Moshe felt a brotherhood with the Jewish people that could only come from his 2 years with his mother and from the daughter of Paro, making sure that Moshe understood that he was a Jew and he was to draw the Jews out. Just as he was drawn out from the water, Moshe, so too he was to draw the Jews out. And he felt that brotherhood with his fellow Jews. So he sees an Egyptian man striking a Jewish man. Now, we were slaves. Slaves get struck all the time. Slaves get beaten, slaves get hit, slaves get whipped. That's life of a slave. It's not fun. So when Moshe saw this, it would not have been noteworthy had it been the regular beatings that the Jews got. This, if Moshe noticed this particular beating, it must have been much more vicious than was typically meted out. So when it says that he saw an Egyptian man striking a Jewish man, it means a vicious beating that was going on. 12, the days, Vayifen ko vacho, he looked both ways. Vayar ki enish, he saw there was no one around. Vayachas ha-mitzri, so Moshe struck the Egyptian. Vayitmenehu bachol, and then buried him in the sand. So Moshe stepped forward to help his Jewish brother, and he committed the ultimate crime. He killed an Egyptian taskmaster, and he saved a Jewish slave. He stood up for the Jewish slave and killed an Egyptian taskmaster. That was a major crime in Egypt. Egypt had no interest in the caste system being undermined. The Jews were the bottom of the totem pole. They were to remain on the bottom of the totem pole. And an Egyptian taskmaster was not to be hindered and not to be stopped in any way.
Yeah. I'm curious. According to Torah, would that be an acceptable thing to do, to kill a person that you saw killing somebody else?
Yes.
It would be.
Yes. If you see someone who is the classic, the way it's described, and of course you extrapolate this to real cases, but the case study, as the Gemara presents it, is you see one man running after a Jew to kill him, you kill the man running after the Jew first, before you can kill the Jew. If you can save the Jew by wounding the first man, then you wound him. But if not, then you kill him. Yeah.
Rabbi, in the translation here, it's quote, Moses killed him by reciting the secret name of Gutsman.
Okay, so that's the Medrash. The Medrash says over here, how did Moshe kill this Egyptian? It really, if you think about it, it's very difficult to understand. Moshe is still young. He's a young man. The taskmaster, you would think he's a powerful person. So Moshe just went over and killed him? I mean, did he sneak up on him with a knife? Like, how did he get him? So the Gemara tells us that he used the name of God to kill him, the name of Hashem. Now, when we say the name of Hashem, Hashem has many names. There are many names in the Chumash that we have that are Hashem's name. There are names that we don't know that also are Hashem's name, that we have lost over the generations. They're not explicit in the Torah, and they were special names. Some of those names, or at least one in particular, the Shema Meforash, God's explicit name, whatever that is so powerful that it can make miracles happen. It is supernatural. It is, people don't know that name today, no one knows it. Those who used to know it were not supposed to tell it to other people. Not only that, but using God's name to make some sort of supernatural occurrence for one's own benefit was strictly prohibited. One was not allowed to use God's name just because. You know, I don't want to do the dishes today. I'll just mention God's name. Oh, the dishes are done. Can't do that. That would be strictly prohibited. That would be a misuse of God's name.
Well, we're not to learn Hashem about.
Okay, that's a very, very good question. But before we get to that question, Moshe, the Medrash tells us, killed this Egyptian by uttering God's name. And Mr. Starkman is asking, how would Moshe have known God's name? How is that possible that he would have known it? That is a very good question, which I don't have an answer for right this minute. I would like to try to research that before next class. And that's a very good question. How would Moshe have known it? Was it that God told him his name? That Moshe already was experiencing some level of prophecy, even though he was not yet a prophet. He doesn't become a prophet until the burning bush, which we'll get to later. So he's not a prophet yet. So, but maybe he had some sort of prophetic understanding of something, that God gave him the knowledge to know his special name. Or maybe he learned it through some Jews, maybe from his brother Aaron. Maybe he somehow got to visit his family now and then, perhaps. Maybe as he got older in the palace, he became more independent and he had more free rein to go as he pleased, to go and come as he pleased, and then maybe he did have interaction with the Jews and was able to learn that name. I don't know. And that's something I would like to research. Yes?
If Moshe was raised in Pharaoh's palace, that gave him tremendous power. So why would, you know, I mean, the Pharaoh could kill 1,000 people and nobody would blink an eye. Why make such a, you know, the, you know, Pharaoh's son or the Pharaoh's, you know, why would they make such a big deal?
As we will see, Moshe is going to be they're going to try to execute Moshe for this.
Yeah, so I don't understand that. Here he has a big position. He has tremendous power.
Because, as
he
I said,
because
killing a taskmaster to save a Jew was the ultimate offense. It's a terrible thing to do. You see, when there is a slave society, a slave mentality, how do you control so many people? How do you control so many people? How do you have millions of people, and they're just meant to listen to their masters and do as they're told. How do you control so many people? The only way to do that is that there is a culture that demands it. And that culture is unbending. That culture is iron tight, iron fisted. It's the only way to maintain that sort of thing. Look at what happened in Egypt recently. Right? When there is a chink in the armor, it falls apart. If you want to have that kind of iron grip, iron control, you can't allow any kind of exceptions to rules. You have to maintain it without any bending at all. The Egyptian system of the Jews on the bottom had to be maintained no matter what. And they couldn't allow for any sort of well, you know, you got to treat them a little nicer, human rights, those poor Jews. No. They're not, you got to treat, you got to dehumanize them, you got to treat them like they're dirt. They're lower than the animals, and then they don't have any rights whatsoever, and they don't have any reason to be protected. There's no such thing. No one should have any sympathy for them. That's what you have to maintain. And as soon as that starts to be chipped away at, that's the beginning of the end of the slave mentality, the slave system.
When Moses matured, he became as one of them.
That's right.
Does this explain why he had to look left and right before he
did? Yes. He made sure there was no one there.
It does look like he was doing something wrong when you start looking hesitating.
Right.
But it's because of all this that he was
doing. Right. Just to make sure that there's no Egyptians to see him do it. Uh-huh. And so he kills the Egyptian, then he buries him in the sand. Right. He's got to make sure that there's no witnesses to the act.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Name that no one knows. This is not the name that Adonai substitutes for.
No.
What is that name? I thought that was...
Whatever it is. I don't know.
No. I
know what you mean.
Yeah.
I don't know. So that's what Moshe does. Now, what is the... Okay, well, there are several things here that are going on which we're going to have to cover, which we'll have to go over this again next week. But let's keep going now for the rest of the story. Vayetze Mayom HaSheni, 13, Yud Gimel, he went out on the second day, meaning the day after the story that just happened. V'hinei Shnei Anoshim Ivrim Nitzim. And behold, there are two Jewish men fighting. Vayomer LaRasha, he said to the evil one, Lama sakereyecha. Why do you strike your brother? So, the first day, Moshe sees an injustice of an Egyptian viciously beating a Jew, and so he kills the Egyptian. The second day, he sees another injustice. He sees two Jews fighting. And so he intervenes. And he says to the one who is about to strike the other one, he says to the evil one, why do you strike your brother? Vayomer, he said, Mi samcha li'ish sar v'shofet aleinu, who puts you as a man who is a... Who is it? What is there?
A ruler
and a judge over us. In other words, who died and made you king? Halahargeni ata omer, do you want to kill me? Kasha haraka samitzri, just as you killed the Egyptian. You want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian? Vayira Moshe vayomar, Moshe was afraid, and he said, Achein noda hadavar. Indeed, the matter is known.
How did they know if he looks like the son?
Okay, so we're about to get to that. So he said to Moshe, do you want to kill me? Are you saying to kill me? How do they translate it here? Do you propose to murder me? That is not an exact translation. The exact translation is, to kill me, are you saying? Are you saying to kill me? Like you killed the Egyptian? This is how we derive that Moshe killed the Egyptian by speech. Because that's what the Jew is saying to Moshe. Are you saying to kill me? the way you killed the Egyptian? Do you want to kill me by speech the same way you killed the Egyptian yesterday? And Moshe was afraid, and he said, indeed, the matter is known. And the simple meaning is that Moshe now was afraid that Paro had found out, because if these Jews knew about it, it must be getting around. And that's why in the next verse, Tezvav 15, Vayishma Paro es hadavar hazem, Paro heard about this thing, Vayavakesh laharoges Moshe, so he wanted to execute Moshe for having killed the Egyptian, Vayivrach Moshe mitzvei Paro, Moshe escaped from before Paro, which is a whole story in and of itself, Vayeshev Beretz Midyan, and he dwelled in the land of Midyan. Midyan is a country which in those days was east of Egypt, in the area south of Israel, east of Egypt. Vayeshev Ala Be'er, and he dwelled near the well because he was looking for a wife. And as we've mentioned before many times, where did a Jewish man go to find a wife?
Yeah.
Goes to a well. Okay. then, of course, we're going to have the whole story with Moshe meeting his wife. We'll get to that later. So the question which we're going to leave off with, which we'll discuss next week, and with many aspects to the story which we'll talk about next week, is really what Mrs. Stockman asked. Moshe looked both ways before he killed the Egyptian. And it says that he saw there was no one there. Fayarki ein ish. He saw there was no one there. He looked both ways. There was no one there. The next day, one Jew says to him, do you want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian? How did he know? How would the Jew know that Moshe had done it if no one was there? Does it say?
Huh? It says that he was prophetically saw that no descendants would come from
that's in addition to seeing no one was there. Vayif and Kobachor, he looked both ways. That was to make sure the coast was clear. Vayar Kianish, he saw there was no descendant who would come from.
Maybe the man is safe still.
Okay. So the only answer that is logical
was saved by Moses, isn't it?
Is there was another man there.
Right.
The man he saved.
Yeah.
The coast wasn't clear. There was someone there. The man he saved. Then the question becomes, then, what is the man he saved? Did he just go tell everybody? What's with the man he saved? Who is the man that he saved? Why was the man being viciously beaten by the Egyptian? Who is this man? And why would he tell what happened? If Moshe was being careful not to let it be known, wouldn't he know that it was dangerous to let it be known? And who are these two Jews who are fighting? All of this is related. It's a deeper story than what we see on the surface over here.
It must have been the reason that the Egyptian that was attacking him and punishing him had to be a reason that he was doing something wrong, and it carried over.
Okay, so we will see. That's very insightful, and we'll see next week. We're going to go through this point by point. We'll go through this. Obviously, we're going to have to draw from the Medrash to understand it better, but the hint that there's more to the story is right in front of our faces. We'll have to go through it.
Right,
he was there. He was right there.
Okay.